starting. Welcome everybody.
Thank you.
This is final session. I'm Anna Radha, some of you know me already. I work at the Centre for Hindu Studies, generally in teaching with the Continuing Education Department. Now just to check with you first, how was today? Is it overload? Do you feel like you've had enough ideas? Yeah, okay. It's good.
Yeah, I think the four lectures...
is a lot.
It is just right.
It's just right. Okay.
Yeah, an hour and 20 minutes is a bit long.
Okay.
But
well, this last session you can be encouraged is short.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, would you mind getting me the clock? I left you at the back there. So I'll try and keep close. So some of my material has actually been touched on by Jessica and Brian Black, so I've cut a nice swathe of information off it for you. So what I'm hoping to do today is maybe draw together some of the ideas in a more analytical way and try and draw some of the, a lot of information perhaps in different frames to consider it. And I liked what Jessica said. She had this wonderful overview of the complex, you know, often chaotic, impenetrable thing that is Hindu studies or Hinduism. But she offered a window on different texts. It's like it's a little encapsulation, a little glimpse of something, and you get a taste. So you try to grasp something of the immense, the big, by looking at the little. So that idea of window I liked. Brian Black, then, in his session this morning, also mentioned that idea of a lens, a way of looking at the world. This Mahabharata was a lens on human life. And both of them asked, for me, the most pertinent question of all. So what? Why are these stories related or of interest to us today, to the reality today? You know, they're full of stories, and some of them are dense philosophical treatises, but ultimately, why were they written? What are they trying to give, or how do they address our lives today? And that's the question I was considering, actually, on my bicycle, cycling in to the centre yesterday. And as you know, it was the great day of voting. And as I cycled down one side of the road, there was people dressed in blue saying, "Remain in," you know, and like it would peppered the sidewalk that all the way in was "Remain." And then on the other side of the road, wearing red, with another, you know, peppering the whole sidewalk all the way into Oxford, was Brexit, or was to leave. So two words, remain, leave. And I was thinking, you know, the Mahabharata is a talk from thousands of years ago. I mean, it's an oral tradition that goes back beyond anyone can measure. How does that apply to this great discussion, this referendum today? Then I went into Cafe Nero Coffee, and the front of the Times was this image of Europe by night. A satellite picture. I quite liked it because it erased all the borders. It gave you this image of the earth. And somehow I connected both images, the remain, the leave, and this image of the earth, without borders, without frontiers, with the Mahabharata. And I was thinking, well, actually, Bharat. Bharat is a word in the Indian constitution that is now designated as India. It was many different options. Bharat Bhumi is considered the larger earth, but Bharat is the many states that comprise India. So it's about a country, a geographical state. It's about power, about, you know, leadership in a geographical, over the earth, really, competing interests. And the particular one in Europe is, you know, to cooperate or to be isolationist, to remain or to leave. And then I thought the Mahabharata is perhaps the biggest teachings of the Mahabharata are all about how to remain in this world, maybe the larger Bharat Bhumi, the world, how to remain in it, how to stay in it, and lead a good life. That's what dharma is about. It's been mentioned today. Dharma is about being in the world, being participating fully, and leading a good life. What is the right way of living? So it's about remaining in the world. And yet, on the other hand, the Mahabharata, as well as many other scriptures, have another strand of thought which recommends how we exit the world, that actually this world, remaining in it, is not all that there is. And I thought of a NAF correspondence. You know, they have the term Brexit. I thought of Brexit. No, how do I say that? Brexit. Brexit. So it seemed like that to the Mahabharata. What does the story of the Mahabharata do? It gives you this immense story of Bharat. Now, it's a Mahabharata. The little story of Bharat, you could say, was the story of Bharat you touched on, Shakuntala, Dushyant, and Bharat, who was their son, became king. But that's just the little Bharat. But Mahabharat, Maha meaning great, big, expansive, talks about everything before that and everything after that. So it gives this expansive, big perspective. Now that big perspective includes this world is not all that there is. So the exit part is about actually leaving at some point too. So I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, here's this small debate, and there are some, you can find some connections with the larger universal issues addressed in the Mahabharata. So that's just my own wacky thoughts. But again, trying to grasp and say, what is the relevance of these texts? So to begin, what I'm going to just look at is Mahabharata. What does it mean by Maha? So a few reflections on that term, Maha. Some of it you've done, so I'll keep that short. So that's like, what is the Mahabharata? Then address a little bit why. Why is it important? Or why was it written? Why is it meaningful? Why is it even relevant? So something about the meaning and the purpose of the Mahabharata. So that's the what and the why. And then the how is, how does the Mahabharata seek to fulfill its meaning? How does the Mahabharata convey its purpose? So three little areas, a what, a why, and a how. So you've had a few PowerPoints, so I thought I'd do some little sketching. I am no artist, but maybe it'll inspire you to do better. You know, get your own creative ideas. For me, doing little sketches like this helps me to think. So, what is the Mahabharata? The word's Maha. It's Maha means great, means big. But in many ways, it fulfills this in many ways. I suppose just the word Maha, do you know any other words that begin with Maha?
Lots,
yeah, shoot off a few.
Maha Pandit,
yeah, it's not just a good pandit, it's a great pandit.
Mahayagya,
it's not just a sacrifice, it's a great sacrifice.
Mother of all
yagyas, yes. There's another one that's very, very famous. Pardon?
Mahadev,
exactly. Just, again, exalting to a very high level. What about the wise sage, Gandhi? Sometimes an epithet. Maha Atma. And again, you have this idea that the soul with the big perspective, the expansive vision. So Maha means big, means expansive. Expansive means many things, many. So the first thing I have is the Mahabharata itself. What is it? Well, it's the story. It's a story, but it's being retold. You know, the Mahabharata itself tells the story again and again. The Mahabharata tells us Vyas composed it, but it didn't stop there. Narada spoke it to the gods. Asita Devala spoke it to the Rakshasas. Vyas spoke it to ask his disciple Vaisampayana to speak it to humans. So the Mahabharata itself gives us these many Mahabharatas going off in different directions. The Mahabharata opens, as you talked on before. Where? Where does the Mahabharata open? What's the first image you get? It's like a movie zoning in. What's the first image of the Mahabharata you get? It's not the battlefield. It's the forest. It's a peaceful ashram with wise sages sitting peacefully in the forest. And they request Ugrashravas, who has already heard this recitation of the Mahabharata, at another fire yagya at King Janamejaya. So he's repeating. Again, it's been repeated there. So he's repeating it in the forest of Namashiranya. So the Mahabharata itself tells us there are many Mahabharats. There are many Mahabharats in it. We also know that there are many regional versions of the Mahabharata. There's the northern recensions, southern recensions, the academics study, the embellishments and the continued narrations that have expanded themselves throughout India and beyond. We know there was a great work called the Critical Edition, something around 1990 to 1960, by a body of Sanskrit experts under V.S. Suptankar, which basically looked at, I don't know exactly, but around 60 manuscripts taken from all around the country and examining, contrasting the various stories and coming up with what they thought was a good critical edition of which were the best, the most popular stories. Now, they may have missed out on some. But a vast Maha work showing the scope of the Mahabharata. So Maha big, Maha many, Maha many stories within, many told retellings without. Thirdly, the Mahabharata itself tells us to keep it going. It tells us to recite this Mahabharata. It tells us that anyone who continues to recite it or to hear it will gain benefits. You'll get blessings in this world and beyond. You'll get relief from sins. You will gain benefits either in Swarga, or you will actually make a Bharaksit. You will actually gain moksha in return. So it recommends the hearing and the retelling. So Mahabharata is Maha in its perspectives, in its propagation of the stories, in its recommendation to the reader, to the hearer, to keep it going. So that's one sense in which it's Maha. Another sense touches on what Jessica did. Maha, I put the umbrella idea here. It's vast in its range of ideas that it has. It basically has everything that is there in Hindu traditions. It's like a big umbrella term under which so many things can shelter. Atma, karma, dharma, yoga, samsara, dhyana, philosophical discourses, you have yogis, you have any idea that you have practically in Hinduism is located in the Mahabharata. But perhaps a few exceptions, not so much about goddess worship, but pretty much everything else is located there. It doesn't really explicitly describe temple worship, but there are mentions of devasthanas, the places of the gods. So it's an umbrella term, like Hinduism itself. The Mahabharata hangs all the ideas we recognize in Hindu traditions today can be located in the Mahabharata. So Mahabharata big because it has all the ideas we know today. Mahabharata big here, what tree is that?
Banyan.
Very good, I'm not that bad at all actually. You recognize Banyan again because Jessica mentioned this in her talk about Julius Lippner gives this motif of the banyan, and it's very good, because what's typical of the banyan? What's its characteristic?
I think it said it grows up, spreads out, and then comes down again.
Yeah, but what's the point?
Like about all-encompassing.
It's not law central of gravity.
Exactly.
Not identifiable central.
No identifiable, exactly. You don't know where it begins, and you don't know where it ends. So it's like that, just like he attributes that term to the vast collection of ideas, beliefs, and practices that are the Hindu traditions. So it might also be applied to the Mahabharata. It's like, because of this constant reverberating and echoing of the story within itself and beyond, you get this sense of where does it begin and where does it end? And of course, the point of the Mahabharata is that it should never end. It's an eternal retelling of universal truths. But we get to that later. So that's the what, the Maha. It's big. But, so then, just wanted to look at it. Why is it important? Why is this big text with its vast scope of ideas and interesting or important? And how has it been approached? Well, maybe just approached first, and then why is it important second? Basically, two ways it's been approached. You could say it's a great story. It's an epic narrative. It's a story of heroes. It's a story of kings. It's a great yarn. And scholars over the centuries have approached it as a singular text with one author, or perhaps it's a body of redactors or editors, or some of it is interpolations they've been stuck in, or there was an original core story that was embellished and framed, perhaps in Vaishnav terms. There's many ways to look at the bits and try and put the bits of jigsaw together. So that's just many ways it has been approached. The second way also says it's a great yarn. But this approach is from the Hindu tradition itself. It says it's not just a story. And that's what I want to focus on this class. So it's like, how does the Mahabharata regard itself from within the Hindu traditions? And the first point is, it's not an ordinary story. Why? Why isn't it an ordinary story? What makes it different? Yeah, go on.
Krishna.
Yeah, Krishna, even more than that. What makes it different? Yeah, but you're right.
There's relevance in our time.
Yeah, that's also a point, but you could say many stories are relevant. You know, you can find thinking in the Greek myths, you could find something in Shakespeare. What's so distinctive about the Mahabharata?
God itself talking in here.
In the Bhagavad, yes, that's one point. The Bhagavad Gita is right there in book 6 of the Mahabharata. And that's a direct dialogue of Krishna, who's Krishna? Krishna, Vishnu, another name for him. So the text itself tells that this is an avatar story, like the Ramayana. There are two great epic narratives that are not simply epic narratives that describe the descent of the avatar to the world. So you get this sense of, in the Mahabharata, I think I've drawn this many times before, not very well any of those times, but for those who may have seen it, you can guess what it is. What is this?
Can it be palace entrance?
Oh, thank you very much. Palace, you give me, you flatter me with your praise. It's a lot more humble than that.
It's a tent.
It's a tent, no, it's not a tent.
It's a stage.
Yes, it's a stage. So that's what the Mahabharata, the great thing, does. These are curtains, this is a stage, and this is the stage here. So what it does is, it tells us, before the drama starts, there is problems in the universe, and that Vishnu descends, Narayan descends on Earth as Krishna. Then the story takes place here, and after the battle is over, and the Pandavas go up the mountain back to heaven, everybody rebounds back into the heaven. So you have this Maha perspective. It's an expansive vision of it. The Mahabharata is not just a story, it's about the avatar. It's about the divine descent on earth. And why does the divine, in Hindu tradition, what's the whole point? He just comes to have a good time, or what?
Restore goodness.
Partially. God Krishna.
You're quite right. There's a whole strand of Leela, the idea of Leela, that actually it is the God's great prerogative to just come and play and enjoy with his. That's one whole strand of thought. What, any other reasons? What's the point of the?
Restore order.
Yes, order being?
Good over.
What's the word?
Dharma.
Dharma, exactly. Dharma. And it's right there in the Bhagavad Gita that you have in chapter 4, that Paritrinayu Sadunam Vinashaya Chadustrikam. He comes to, you know, destroy the demoniac upset of Dharma in the world and to restore balance and harmony in behavior in the world. What? You did that today? Well, who did you
do? We need that today.
Well, exactly. It's very interesting because, yeah, who knows where this Brexit thing is going? It's just starting. Things are changing. You know, the earth's been, somebody said on the radio today, it's like an earthquake, a political earthquake. But who knows? But yeah, things are changing and it could shake things up a little bit. And Dharma, who knows which way? Is it going to be for good or is it going to be for bad? Who knows? Will it create more war in the world? When you read the papers, there's an awful lot of war, it seems, going on at the moment. Is this going to exacerbate it? Is it going to placate it? Is it going to help in any way? So these questions, they're there in front of us. The Mahabharata dealt with these issues of war, violence, governance, leadership, you know, how to avert violence in the war, in the world. You know, these issues are all there. So the Mahabharata is not an ordinary story, it's an avatar story. It is considers itself, as I've got a view here, its glasses, it regards itself as good as the Vedas. is the fifth Veda because of the fact that the avatar is present. I'll just read you briefly how it describes the sages of Namishiranya, how it opens the Mahabharata. You have Shonaka meets sage Ugrashravas. And this is the request for information. You know, like the Ramayana starts with a question, who's the ideal man? And then Valmiki recites the Ramayana. Here we have Shonaka requesting, and he says he requests to Ugrashravas, who has heard it, already recited at the sacrifice, snake sacrifice of King Janamejaya. So Shonaka says, we wish to hear this ancient tale composed by Dvaipayana, the foremost of seers, which the very gods and holy Brahmins applauded when they heard it. It is a most excellent story, splendid in wording and narration. It's full of subtle sayings. It's adorned with Vedic lore. The history of the Bharat War, Vyasa's wonderful composition, it forms a sacred canon equal to the four Vedas. It is holy in word and sense. It is elegant and it is enriched with a variety of learning. We wish to hear it, just as Vaisampayana, the seer, related it on the instruction of Dvaipayana at King Janamejaya's sacrifice, winning acclaim. Why do we want to hear it? For it is full of dharma and dispels evil and fear. So here you have, the stage is set, the book is opened. It starts with the sages of Namashiranya. So tell us the story because it dispels evil and fear. So, that's interesting. Why did I talk about it? Oh yeah, Mahabharata's own view of itself as important because it teaches dharma. It's important because it's equal to the Vedas. It's important because it's an avatar story. So, here, it's very interesting actually, this location of the sages of Namishiranya, as I said, it's peaceful. So the story is narrated. And what is the story of the Mahabharata compared to the sages of Namishiranya?
A family.
Yeah, but what kind of, like you touched on it with Brian Black, you were talking about the dishonoring of Draupadi and this central Adharmic incident that's pivotal to the story. So what's this whole central story of the Kauravas and the Pandavas about?
Right and wrong.
It's about right and wrong. It's about trying to see what dharma is. But it's a story of war and violence and two opposing sides in conflict and the view of how to avert war. But ultimately war comes and you get this whirlpool of bloody massacre, this whole books of violence in the Mahabharata. And it's awful, and it's detailed, and it's descriptive. And it sort of sucks you in, like a whirlpool. And then, after it's all over, it sort of spits you out the other side. And where do you end up? Where does the book close? Back with the sages of Namishiranya. So again, you have this idea. I said, the book starts with the telling of the sages. Please tell us the story. The story is narrated, and it has many, many, many stories within it. And then it returns at the end, after the Pandavas have returned to heaven, after everyone has gone back to the celestial world, we return to the sages, and what do they say? They repeat the importance of the Mahabharata. They repeat the importance of the Mahabharata as the Vedas, as a text that overcomes fear and evil. So it views itself as important at the beginning, throughout, and at the end. And that it dispels fear and evil. That is it. And you appreciate it even more, having gone through the whole maelstrom or whirlpool of violence and tension and combat and conflict and revenge and retribution. That is the story of the Pandavas and the Kauravas. So, the Mahabharata views itself as very important. Why is it important? We said some of those reasons. And why is because it's a shastra, it's a sacred text, it's not an ordinary story. And in Hindu, in all traditions, sacred scripture or sacred text serve two functions. They're not just to entertain, they're to teach. And they're to initiate practice. You call it a didactic function and a liturgical function. It has a telly bit and it has a doey bit. So that's what the Mahabharata does. The telly bit is showing you, telling you how to be a good person, dharma predominantly. It has many, many other teachings inside, but predominantly it's how to remain in this world and act well. And there are great tracks within it that tell you how to escape from this world and attain moksha or heaven, to go beyond the immediate. So it tells you, it doesn't just tell you, because to give knowledge in Hindu traditions is not simply academic knowledge. It's not just let me tell you, and then it's an academic, okay, I understand that reasonably, logically, and rationally. No, it doesn't do that. It sucks you in and it shows you. It shows you what does dharma look like. What does an adharmic person look like, first of all? Because sometimes it's easier to recognize the lack of dharma than it is to recognize dharma. So it shows you dharma, but it does it in a very maha way. Again, a broad-minded way. It shows you here on one end you have Yudhisthira, and on the other hand you have Duryodhana and his brother Dushasana, who again were pivotal in disrobing Draupadi and that ghastly dishonoring of her. So you have two ends. Both of them are kings. Both of them are rulers. Both of them wield power over the lives of others. So dharma is taught by the Mahabharata, but it doesn't just tell you. It shows you what does Yudhisthira's version of dharma look like. How does he walk? How does he talk? How does he act? How does he speak? And they backdrop it all in adversity, because the acid test of character is in adversity. You get to see the metal of a person or the make it of the man when there's a backdrop of suffering. So the Mahabharata is maha in its suffering as well. So if you think, you know, you think you've got problems with remain and leave. What about the Pandavas? You know, here they are, rulers of the world. They've got Indraprastha. They've got all the wealth, acknowledgement, and acclaim that they deserve. They're qualified heroes. And then, with one game of dice, just like that, gone. What happens to them? Where do they go? Yes, 13 years of exile. They become the migrants. Very qualified migrants off into the forest, and their poor mother looking at her qualified jobs out of a job. You know, her sons who are so qualified to rule. 13 years now. Maha suffering. So if you've got a problem with not being given the stages you deserve in life, or perhaps not being recognized for your talents, well, think of that. Is it 13 years of exile in the forest? No. So the Mahabharata does this maha thing again. It expands the perspective on everything. And in dharma particularly, it shows you Yudhisthira in adversity. It shows you Duryodhana in adversity. When Duryodhana has a hard time, he seethes with rage. He combusts with envy and jealousy and hatred. And there's wonderful tracts that describe practically the toxicity of his sentiment. Compared to Yudhisthira, who on the other hand, well, he seems immune to humiliation, and that's also questionable. Draupadi is disrobed and dishonored. They're exiled for 13 years. It's obviously a setup by Shakuni and the dice, but he accepts it. And then in the middle here, we have another view of dharma. Dharma as in, again, the dharma particularly focuses on people in responsibility.
So in the minds of a scholar, are there any redeeming features of Yudhisthira?
Are there any redeeming features? There are lots of redeeming features. Oh, absolutely. In fact, the Mahabharata itself calls him the Dharma Raj. He's the one who doesn't fall. You know, at the end of the Mahabharata, the Pandavas all go back to heaven in the Svargahanika, the Mahaprasthanika. They have the last journey to the heaven. It's Yudhisthira who falls last. And he is acclaimed by Dharma, who is the dog. You know, he has a little dog and he refuses to go into heaven. You heard that story. But it's actually Dharma. They're testing him. And Yudhisthira is recognized as the best of those of Dharma. But it seems to be that there's no perfection in the world. There's something about that he's as good as it gets, but there's liffiness. It's like, we've talked about this in other situations, it's like if somebody, you know, humiliates your wife or burgles your house and you call the police, and the police say, listen, you know, have a cup of tea, it's okay, she'll be fine, you get other things. You know, the burglar or the rapist or... he's probably had a difficult childhood. You know, you should understand. You know, why don't you sit and, you know, have a cup of tea and just forgive? You know, so the Mahabharata does that to you. It does that. It sets you up with Draupadi and that, and so many other things that Duryodhana does. And then it gives you Yudhisthira, who's like, well, Dharma is something, I feel it in my heart. You should forgive. You should forgive. There's a higher destiny going on. There's something bigger, maha, than the little perspective. And then, you're showing another one, the one I love here. We all listen to it. Bhima. Now, earlier, I think Brian Black mentioned the three incidences where Draupadi is dishonored, she's assaulted. It says something, too, about the power of beauty. In one sense, it's a force of nature. It's dangerous. It has to be protected. Anyway, so Bhima, I mean, he's another vision of Dharma. What is the good way to be a king? What is the good way in the world to wield power over others' lives, to lead? And he pulverizes Kichaka so badly that he's unrecognizable. He's like a box. It's not even recognizably human. So Bhima does that, and then Bhima has another thing. Does anybody remember what Bhima says when Dushasana drags Draupadi out by the hair before the assembly of elders? At the end of that, what does Bhima vow to do? Come on, give us a little bit of, what does he say? He doesn't say, oh, I'm going to...
chest and drink his blood.
A little bit more than that. Give us more.
With rage and anger, fury in his eyes.
Oh, you're not a Bhima. He doesn't he says, I will tear your heart out and I will rip out your heart and drink your blood. That's what he does. You know, he says, I'm going to tear your heart out and I'm going to drink it. No, it's like, you really get into this. Bhima is huge. Bhima is strong. Bhima is Dharma of a king. When, you know, you would like to, yeah, the person who, you know, dishonors your wife, rapes your family's honor and does something heinous. Bhima is the face that comes and, you know, but still, you see, the Mahabharata does a brilliant thing. It makes you look, it's like, you know, you're going, yes! It's like, rip out your heart and drink your blood. It's just a little bit ghastly. It's just like, there's a side that's so satisfying that he's the one who deals with Kichaka, satisfying that he deals with low-life Dushasana, but it's just distasteful. You know, it's like, it's a little, does he go too far? So Dharma, 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 how to be good in the world, particularly in relation to leadership, governance, power, exerting influence over other people's lives, a position of great responsibility. Look at Yudhisthira, look at Duryodhana, look at Bhima. And you've thrown in there Bhishma, another one. So the Mahabharata, Maha, doesn't give you one picture. Jessica mentioned this, Brian Black mentioned this. This genius way of expanding your perspective to different points of view. So it's not just, oh yeah, well, you know what Dharma is? Dharma is to be truthful, to never tell a lie, and to not steal, and to be honest, and to do your ritual worship. No, it's not like that. Dharma is, as the word is, shukshma. It's something subtle. And you, as Yudhisthira said, you feel it in your heart. And Dharma, the Mahabharata shows us that intrinsically linked to knowing Dharma, to seeing Dharma, to understanding Dharma, is character. Is the character. So it's like the character of one's capacity to comprehend Dharma is linked to character. It's like, if your character is as impeccable and self-controlled and as well-behaved as Yudhisthira, he had that capacity to see the bigger picture. We see the same of the idea of Maha-Atma. Anyone who is regarded as a Maha-Atma is generally regarded to be good in their behavior. They have a good character. And that links to their perspective a little bit more. So, why is it important? Because Mahabharata tells us it's important. Other approach to it may be academic. There's so many ways scholars can approach it. The main teaching, although there are many teachings, is karma, remaining in this world, but also there's strands in the Mahabharata, vast tracts, teaching. I mean, Brian Bach mentioned some of them. They're didactic passages that kind of deviate from the main story and give you much more information and teachings on how to practice yoga, how to escape the duties of the world, and ultimately how to attain moksha. So,
another aspect which you contrast with the idea of perfection or imperfection as it exists in the Abrahamic religions, you have the concept of maha rather than perfection. Perfection itself as being something to seek. Isn't it? I mean, you start here with the idea that nobody's perfect, as if that is a matter for debate.
Mm-hmm.
Here, there is no debate about imperfection because it's a recognized attribute.
Yeah, right. There's no perfection in the world. The realm of humanity is ultimately flawed. And there's a very nice story in that. I think, was it Brian Black mentioned? Yes. Where Krishna has to intervene when Arjuna is going to kill Yudhisthira. So it's like, oh, come on, you know, like, be practical. It's like, come on, it's like Dharma is something that upholds life, that the welfare of all, it's supports, nurtures life. So very pragmatic. So you're right, sometimes there's so much Dharma, the Dharma Shastras of Jessica, the details and the, you know, it's ad nauseum, ad infinitum. But what the Mahabharata recognizes is that there's no single, simple answer. Why? Because there's no single, simple kind of human. Because there's no single, simple situation. It recognizes, acknowledges complexity. Why? Because human life is complex. And it constantly awards us this vision, which is this is how it teaches, it shows you what it means to have broad vision. It shows you many maha viewpoints, not one single view, not one single type of person is a type of situation. There's lots of different things that have to be taken into consideration. And even our own lives are like that. Things happen not just for one single reason. Things happen because of, you could say, karma. You could say because of the action of somebody else, a blessing, a benevolence, or a curse, or an adverse something. Things happen because of ancestral genetics. You could say that that's partly karma. Things happen because of an overlap of other events. So the Mahabharata recognize the big picture, that there are many overlapping realities, that no single person exists in a vacuum. Everything is interconnected. Our lives are, as I speak here now, something I say may trigger something in your head that your grandmother said back in something, or an event that happened to you reminds you of something we said in the Mahabharata. And like this, you get this constant overlapping of stories, constant overlapping of lives, constant overlapping of ideas. And it's, you know, it may not be simple, it may be complex, but it's more real. This is its portrayal of reality. It's very broad and very maha and very big. And this is the genius of the Mahabharata. So this is what I'm focusing on is, maha, big, the greatness, the bigness of the Mahabharata. And another way how it does this is, the house we've mentioned is in its scope and its contents, and also in its manner of presenting its teaching by showing it, not just illustratively showing it, doesn't just tell you, and it draws you into the narrative by participating in the story. You hear it, perhaps you retell it, your grandmother perhaps hears you, maybe it's an experience, you participate in it. But Maha also is, it gives you in one sense divine eyes. Now, I like this term. It occurs throughout the Mahabharata, and it's consistent with the Mahabharata's view of itself as a shastra. Because the function of a sacred text is to teach and is to help you to practice, those two things, two functions. So you often hear the word that to see through the eyes of Scripture, that actually Scripture isn't just talking about ordinary reality, and that's true because it has these kind of celestial, way beyond the scope of the reality we know, depicted in it. It gives you these enormous cosmological images. It expands our reality, you could say vertically, into sort of denizens of heaven and beyond, the world of Brahman, moksha. The cosmos is extraordinary. The time scale, the yugas are expansive. So you could say it expands it all, you know, vertically. That way it's expansive. And horizontally. What I mean by horizontally is that it's like it's no single event happening. It's no single truth. Everything is interconnected. So one life will have a story behind a story behind a story behind a story behind a story. That's what the Mahabharata does. It tells a story, the Pandava story, but there's a story behind a story behind a story behind a story behind a story, and it seems to never end. It seems to have this expansive, never beginning and never ending interconnection of stories. So, expanding vertically and horizontally, it's Maha, big vision, this divine eyes through Scripture. And by offering these ginormous, expanded pictures, we see our own lives in their context. And the idea is that we too will be expanded by that exposure, by the participation in it. Now, I mentioned just that one thing. If you think you've got a problem with loss of status, there are innumerable, the dilemmas and the stories offered are universally applicable. So they occur here in the particular Mahabharata story, but they have universal application. There's, you know, if even something like transgenderness is all of the rage now, it's in the newspapers all the time. What story do you know that depicts a story about transgender situation?
Isn't there one here, Amba's?
Yes.
Shikhandi.
Shikhandi and Amba. Exactly, there's a story about transgender. Poor old, you know, Amba, and I'm not going to, I think Brian Black mentioned that story. Amba was distraught because Bhishma, you heard all of that. But anyway, she came back as Shikhandi, and that is a story because she was born as a girl, but actually later became a man, and there's a story behind that too. But yes, there we have, if you have a problem with that, read the story of Amba and Shikhandi, and that's Maha, epic of kind of not fitting in society. As Amba, she was outside of society by being deprived of her right to marry. Her husband to be, her marriage all fell apart because of what Bhishma did. So she was on, her life was ruined, you could say. And then as Shikhandi, yes, she had this, you know, male-female existence. She wasn't sure. You had something there?
No.
Not yet. No. Okay. So there's that. There's, you know, are there any other situations you can think of? Yeah.
When he has, in the 1 year that he had to, went into heaven.
Nice one. Yes, what happened then? He had a year in heaven, and he
was a woman.
He was in heaven.
Yes, so you see, that's the thing. There's a fluidity here. There's always a much bigger, it's not just what you see in this world. There's things going on all different levels. It's Maha in its context and specific. But you're right, he got cursed that he was basically going to be a eunuch for a year. And that became a very useful curse. Because the curse became very useful because on the 13th year of the Pandavas' exile, do you remember what happened? They were incognito in the kingdom of King Virata.
That's right.
And Arjuna took a particular position. He was the dance teacher to the girls, to the princesses. But that was because, well, you know what, everything's interconnected, there's a bigger picture, because he was cursed when he was in heaven, when he had another story, and he was going, so everything sort of ricochets and is interconnected. So again, you get this expanded perspective the Mahabharata does, between big, and then we go back to our little lives. And our little lives are expanded because of the expanded stories of suffering, the expanded story of loss, the expanded stories of, you know, of governance and the difficulties, of humiliation, coming in exile, of anger, jealousy, rage, of competition, rivalry, of prowess in sport, old age, of getting old, and dwindling in power. Dhritarashtra, a study in someone. You know, Dhritarashtra is the father, and he knows what's right. He is a wise king. But how is he born?
Blind.
Yeah. Yeah, he was born blind. But he should have been the rightful king, and his brother Pandu took over. So with Dhritarashtra, you get this constant back and forth. It's like, you know, I know the Pandavas are good. I serve the Pandavas. But I should have been king. You know, it's like, it's not quite right. But no, they're good. They're good, Duryodhana. Leave them alone. But yes, my son should be king. It's like, yes, but I know what the right thing to do is. But God, it's hard to do it. It's hard to do it. You know, it's like, and you constantly get this fluctuation. And you know what? Do you recognize yourself in it? Well, I can speak for myself. It shows you. It shows you. This is what it looks like to have convictions. This is what it is to know something and have the weakness of spirit to carry it out, or to be afflicted with envy or jealousy. This is what it looks like. Are you a Dhritarashtra? Are you a Duryodhana? Are you a Dushasana? Are you a Bhima? Are you a Yudhisthira? Look at these characters. Who are you? Which one inspires you? And that's what the Mahabharata does. It doesn't just show you the story of Bharata, it shows you the Mahabharata of all of these characters, all of these expansive stories, you know, and that go well beyond the central story of the Pandavas and the Kauravas, so many things. So how it does it? It expands, it gives you these divine eyes. I say divine eyes because normally, well, we can't see these cosmological realms. They're just way beyond, you know, reason. We see our world, our town, our families, our immediate reality. Just as Arjuna looked at the battlefield at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, he saw what is before him. The Mahabharata goes way beyond that. It tells you the past, and it shows you the future. And in this sense, it's acting as divine eyes. You see, in the beginning, we are told that Vyas is not an ordinary reciter or composer of the Mahabharata. He is also an incarnation of Narayan who has divine eyes. He sees the past, the present, and the future. So therefore, this story has given us a view of something beyond human reasoning. It shows us at the beginning, in the first book, you have an image of Dhritarashtra lamenting all that happened to bring the end of the war, for his sons to be destroyed. So it starts with the end in mind. You're given this divine eyes to see the end. So that, why? Why do you think the Mahabharata does this? How is it trying to teach us Dharma by giving us this mix-up of past, present, and future? Why is it doing this? How can that teach us Dharma? Or what can it teach us?
Perspective,
exactly. It gives you perspective because what is it we don't have here in our lives? What is the thing we don't have? You know, here we are sitting in here and we're trying to worry about our lives, we're worried about our jobs, we're worried about our family, we're worried about our finances, we're worried about next year, we're worried about a million things. It just goes on, there's worries. But what is it we don't have?
Crystal ball, really.
Yeah, crystal ball, you're right. Like, even the Brexit thing, there's a new worry for you, in case you haven't got enough. Now it's like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? What's going to happen? Is the sterling going to be, is the pound going to devaluate? Is this going to ricochet into other things in Europe? How is that going to affect trade? How is that going to affect house prices? How is that going to affect supermarket prices? How is it going to affect passports? How is it going to affect the world? How is it going to affect the ISIS situation? How is it going to affect terrorism? So it shakes the whole thing. It's like, how is it going to do? But we don't know. 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 So this is what the Mahabharata does. It tells you, look at these people who act dharmically. Take your pick. Giving you these situations. Now these situations are particular to the story. It's the story of the Pandavas and the Kauravas. But then it does this Maha thing. And actually, surprise, surprise, it applies universally. These are human nature qualities. So our little lives with our little existences in our little worlds and our little, you know, families and locations can be expanded by immersion and participation in this expanded representation of individuals. Is that 10 more minutes? 15 more minutes. Okay. So, yes. So this divine eye, this is one of the ways Mahabharata is showing us how, beginning with the end in mind. We don't have this luxury. It gives us to it so that we will bring it into our lives. And the purpose is so that it's a scripture. It's trying to not just teach us, it's trying to transform our own lives. So the teaching of a shastra or a sacred text is, as I said, not academic knowledge. It doesn't tell by logic and reason. It shows you, gives you this confused view of time, past, present, and future. It allows you to see consequences. It allows you to see the end of particular behaviors. And it allows you to think, reflect on your own life in the light of these divine perspective, you might say. The same thing happens in the Bhagavad Gita, Divya Chakshush. Arjuna is, again, it starts off a crisis we can all relate to. He's having a nervous breakdown, basically. He's faced with a task. Now, who's got some, hands up, who's got something difficult? What's the most difficult thing you've had to do this year? You don't have to tell me if you don't want to, but just put your hand up if there's something difficult you've had to do.
How many times a day?
Oh, how many times a day? That real difficult, something you had to face that you really did not want to do. Is there something you can think of?
Now everything builds into insignificance.
Well, that's the point. That's the point, exactly, as I said. And sometimes I still take regard. And this is why this ancient text is relevant. It's like, when I think I've got a problem, you know, it's like, you know, I've got to do something I don't want to do, I think, well, I don't have to stand in front of a battlefield and kill all my relatives and friends and enemies and all my elders, and I don't have to do that. You know, it's like, well, I think I've got a problem. I don't think anybody's got that kind of a problem. You know, it's like, thankfully and hopefully things don't escalate, but it's as bad as it gets. And then you see how knowledge or vision, a transformed sense of reality, an expanded view, can totally transform his behavior. So the start of the Bhagavad Gita, he's paralyzed. The end of the Bhagavad Gita, he's energized. So this knowledge that was spoken is a knowledge that expanded, gave a perspective that was way beyond what he saw. Because what he saw crippled him. What he saw paralyzed him. He was not able to act. So again, what the Bhagavad Gita, again, is located in the Mahabharata and addresses many of the things. We'll talk about that in the next class on the Bhagavad Gita. It expanded his perspective to a much bigger thing that basically, yeah, there's more to matter than meets the eye. The whole Atma teaching is given there, that actually we are spiritual beings having a human experience. It's a complete alter. It's not just human. There's much more than what is visible to the eye. And that's what the Mahabharata is doing. It's just expanding that whole perspective. So just to end, one last point on the going back to the sages of Namasharanya, who start off with the request, tell us this story. So there in this forest of peace, the story is narrated with all its convolutions and stories behind stories and sub-stories, and we're sucked into this, you know, chaos of complexity and overlapping stories and lives and drama and heart-rending pain and suffering and violence. And then we just end up at the end, we're back to the sages of Namasharanya. And all the Pandavas have gone back to heaven, and the whole thing's kind of, the world has fallen apart, and then it's all wound up. And it's like time has just seemed like a dream. It's like you just woke up. And this, again, is a particular teaching with Hinduism. Again, it's like the story starts in a peaceful place. So much goes on. And then it ends, and it's like, oh, you were always there in Namasharanya, in a peaceful place. Likewise here, you know, there was always this spiritual realm, or this realm beyond the stage of the battle and the Kauravas and the Pandavas, and then it goes back to it, and the curtains close, and the drama's over, and there's a much bigger reality. And so you have this, yeah, the Mahabharata expands our perspective. It gives us divine eyes to see beyond the smallness of our own realities, the littleness of our own perspectives. And I will finish with a quote at the very end of the Mahabharata. I read you the one that opens it. This one, again, gives you a sense of how it's asking you to consider its story beyond the particulars of the narrative. So, when Blessed Vyas, the great seer, first compiled this tale, he taught it to Sukha, his son, together with these four verses. Now, close your eyes and listen to these verses. Thousands of mothers and fathers, hundreds of sons and wives, come into existence after existence only to pass away, and more will do so. Thousands of occasions for joy, hundreds of occasions for fear, trouble the fool day after day, but not the learned man. Here I cry out, arms raised, and no one hears me. Both wealth and pleasure spring from Dharma, so why is Dharma not followed? Not for pleasure, not for fear, not for greed should one ever abandon Dharma, not even to save one's life. Dharma is eternal. Happiness and misery are not eternal. The living self is eternal. The body through which one lives is not. So I'll leave it with that, and if you have any questions...
I have one question.
Please feel free to...
First of all, it was very good, thank you.
Yeah.
The question is that as a scholar of Hinduism, you must observe a lot of gurus who step out of India, travel around the world, have a big following.
Yeah.
What is it that they interpret, and does that resonate with the way you study Hinduism?
Some of it does. You see, it's a yes and a no thing. Like, I go back to Jessica's view. The study of religion, the study of Hindu traditions, requires that you step back and look at the whole picture and how they all fit in together. In one sense, it's a more dispassionate voice. At the Center of Hindu Studies, we try to step inside and outside. So often what happens is there will be particular traditions. And they will, like, for example, you'll have the devotional traditions, you'll have this more the Advaitin traditions, and they'll have a particular lens on the world. Now, there'll be lots of commonality of ideas, but they'll have a particular lens on that world. And that difference will be there. And so the name that is Hindu traditions accommodates variegated expressions of beliefs and practices in Hinduism. That's what it's about. In fact, even the Mahabharata, even the Bhagavad Gita, recognizes that there are different kinds of intelligences. There are different kinds of people in the world. So therefore, there's naturally going to be different kinds of expressions of belief. And I think it's a great strength of both Hinduism and the Mahabharata to be able to offer you many different viewpoints. Now, the Mahabharata will have its weighting. It certainly tells us that Yudhisthira, in its opinion, is the best version of this. It certainly tells you in the Bhagavad Gita what Krishna's attitude to it is. So there are definitely weightings in different parts of it. But it allows you, as Jessica said, you know, it says in chapter 18 of the Gita, yate chasita tha kuru, you know, do what you wish to do. Think about it. Consider it. So back to, you know, so the point I'm trying to say is, yes, there are many different denominational sectarian perspectives. Accommodate them, of course. Absolutely. They come under the umbrella, the banyan tree, that is. So you educate yourself and you decide what it is you want to do. And I mean, in the whole of Hinduism, it's about seeking a teacher that inspires you. If a teacher inspires you, you like his character, you think they live a way that's attractive, then yeah, ask him a question. So that's how there's fluidity there. It's like, and that's what the Mahabharata says. It's what is the character that impresses you most about one who practices Dharma? Somebody else? Is that okay?
That's fine.
Anybody else got something?
No, I was just going to ask, you know, that's one of the questions.
question that I was going to have is why wisdom is considered the most.
Why is he considered the most?
Why is he, and for example, for me, the very fact that he was the one who gambled away.
Rascal.
And that his sense of objectivity was almost absolute.
Absolutely. You're quite right. And the Mahabharata's infuriating because it agrees with you like that, and then it'll give you Draupadi. And Draupadi, she'll actually present exactly your perspective and says, you know, there's you again, like the situation, if something heinous happens to your family, do you want a Yudhisthira? It's like, come on, man, you know, man up, deal with it. It's like, and she does that, but he says, no, Draupadi. He says, he had this vision that Dharma is subtle. He had a sense of something bigger was going on, something more was unfolding, and he had this capacity to intuit that it wasn't just what it seems. And yet Draupadi's point of view was also very dharmic, another view of dharma. It's actually, you create action by action. You know, you see, a house doesn't get built if you don't get the bricks and you build and put the house together, and what you need, action. So come on, act. This, you don't wait for destiny or for things to unfold subtly, you know, just create it. So it gives you this, and it's infuriating sometimes, but why? What is it doing? It's expanding your perspective, because it's very easy to think, well, I've got a, you know, monopoly on truth, you know, I disagree with you because I'm right. And, you know, this is what we do all the time, but the Mahabharata won't let you away with that. It will actually give you, like Arjuna, how brilliant is that, the beginning of Arjuna? It's like, don't you agree with him? You mean, don't you agree that this dialogue from Krishna is spoken at a point when you have to kill? And of course you go, why should you kill? Yeah. What was that, Val? I didn't read it. Okay. 5 minutes, exactly. So again, it's the how it does it. It sucks you in and forces you to participate, because it's not an epic, just alone a story. It's a shastra. It has functions to teach, to transform, and to help you participate. That's what it is. It's a liturgical, to actually get involved. And the point is that it continues today because people continue to hear the Mahabharata, continue to recite it. We're here today, 2016, on the Day of Reckoning, talking about the Mahabharata, when the whole world might be falling around beyond our ears. Who knows? And here we are talking about it. Yes, you have something.
But isn't it interesting that he's the hero, but he's a flawed character? And the reason why he lost the dice was they cheated. But they cheated knowing that he could not play because of his weakness. So everyone knew it was his weakness. Like an alcoholic, everyone knows he's an alcoholic except him. So like the frog marched Yudhisthira into it. And some of the other people in the hall were kind of going, oh no. You know, everyone knew this is a car crash. Yeah, that was, no one just knew how big a car crash was going to be.
But even he knew it was a car. But again, why was he doing it? To honor his father, Dhritarashtra. He was doing it as an honor. He was invited to the match, so he was doing the honorable thing. Let's have it. But you're right. It's like it gives you this again infuriating way to be forced to consider it all. Anybody else? Last comments, thoughts? Yeah.
Why is it written as a narrative, as a storytelling, and not a direct story?
How do you mean?
Do you know, it's been told, the story's been told after another, it's like been told two or three times,
yeah.
But it's not the story. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, you mean why is there more to it than just the main story?
No, why is it being told in the way it has been?
What do you think? Okay, why? That's a good point. Just going back to the Maha, why is it that you get this sense of that it's being told to the gods, it's being told, you know, to the devas and to the demons and to humans, and it's just, you get this sense of reverberating throughout the universe. You get this timelessness that it has no beginning and it has no end. that it's constantly re-echoing and reverberating, and it's kind of going in these cycles through time.
It's timeless, isn't it?
Exactly. That's the point. It messes your head up with time. It totally confuses you with time. You can't actually know where you are with the Mahabharata. It's like, what did he say? That was that yucky thing, but then it was that. Who's that man? And then there's another sub-story, and it's like, what stories, and where am I? I thought I was in this story. Yeah, but there was another story that reminds me of that story, which tells you something. And it just, and it goes, expands and expands and expands. And it's immense, and it's mad. But the point is that you find that your own little life, the littleness of your, you know, reality, is imbued with meaning by the Mahabharata. It's actually expanded in its... And ultimately, what the Mahabharata says itself to aim is to transform you into, a, you know, what to understand what Dharma is, to teach Dharma, and ultimately to choose which is the better way to live. It's not just an academic knowledge. It's about bringing you to a better understanding of your own life, and ultimately to remain or to exit. Both, you know, how to behave when you remain and how to, you know, exit well.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.